Rahatsu 2023. There's been mention of the Platform Sutra by the sixth ancestor a number of times. And I think it's worth noting it, just because it's such a classic. And here's basically where this, the beginning part of the sutra goes. Some young kid is out working on the road. He gets hit in the head by a rock and decides he's enlightened. He decides, I'm going to run off to see the Dalai Lama. He runs off to India to see the Dalai Lama, and he walks into the Dalai Lama's audience chamber, and the Dalai Lama takes one look at him and says, you're just a fat old American, full of greed. What are you doing here? And the kid says, well, you're the same. We're not different. And the Dalai Lama says, well, go work on the road for 9 months. And then, after 9 months later, he comes and finds him again and says, oh, you are a spiritual hero, obviously. You obviously are somebody who has deep insight. You're very wise, you know. Let me give you some special things here. These special things, go run off with them and hide in the woods for a while. And the kid goes and wanders around lost in the woods for a bunch of years and suddenly comes out and sees a flag and tells everybody, stop. Don't move. I'm going to free you. That's the beginning of the Platform Sutra. There are much better stories around than that. But it has some elements in it that we all like. You know, we all like to hear, oh, I'm just kind of wandering around doing my own thing, and suddenly, whack, I got it. And we're kind of looking around, seeing where the whack's going to come from. We walk out in the rain hoping that lightning will strike us somewhere nearby, and then suddenly we'll be nothing but light and all of our impurities will be burnt away and we'll be able to go out and rescue the masses. You know, the spiritual hero myth, the spiritual hero archetype is a lovely archetype. It's one that attracts all of us. You know, I hope that somehow, we all hope in our hearts that somehow, you know, this divine being will be recognized and this divine being will then be able to shed light and liberate everybody else, and everybody will acknowledge us for who we are and how wonderful. It's a nice myth. And I think everybody has a little hope in their heart. Somehow I won't have to do all that hard work, and you know, just somebody in the kitchen will hit me with a spoon and then whack, all taken care of. Yeah, that'd be great. Great. But let's look at it a little more closely. Life does whack us on the head with spoons all the time, so you know, it's always possible. But here, right now, in this moment, we have to be like scientists of the mind. We have to really examine what's in front of us. We have to examine what is. We have to examine the sixth ancestor story. We have to examine our own mind. We have to examine what's in this room. We have to look at it really clearly. We have to observe. You know, what do we observe? We observe the floor and the bodies in the room. We observe our breath, our thoughts. Now, if we are observing the breath and we're closely looking at the breath, we can't find it. It doesn't exist. There is no such thing as breath. If we are trying to examine a single thought, we can't find it. There is no such thing as a thought. There is no such thing as a thought. There is no such thing as breath. So please, we want to verify this. We don't want to just, you know, have some bumptious person pontificating, but we're going to verify if we really are looking closely and we're doing breath practice, whatever that means, And we're really looking closely at the breath. What is it that we're actually looking at? What is it that we're actually able to put under the microscope and observe? And if we put something under this microscope of our mind and we try to observe it really intimately, try to observe it really closely, we find it slips away. That we try to observe a thing we call the breath, a thing we call a thought, and we look closely at them, the very closeness of our looking is part of the very disappearance. Interesting. We may be able to have some stand apart feeling of, yes, there's this thing called flow, a flow of thought, a flow of ideas. But when we get right up close and look at it, the subject and the object have a different relationship. In a way, it's like a microscope trying to look at running water. So we've got a microscope, we're looking at this stream, and the stream is flowing through, and it's flowing through. We try to catch a little thing or a bit or a drop or a paramecium or something, and before we know it, it's gone, it's gone, it's gone. The more closely we look, the faster it disappears. The more closely we try to get something in focus, the more ephemeral it becomes, the more holes it has in it, the more elusive it becomes, the more dreamlike it becomes, the more phantasmagoric it becomes. Slips away. So in a way, what we are seeing or think we're seeing is only a gross level. We're kind of standing back far enough that we can then assess and think, oh, there's a thing out there. So, right now, right here, you notice a thought. Think petunia, or an image of a petunia, or an idea of a petunia, or the letters of a petunia, or the feeling of a petunia, or the smell of a petunia, or the color of a petunia, whatever it is that means petunia to you. It could be in ear, all of those things. And you could even say petunia, 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 petunia. But as soon as the mind stops thinking, the petunia is gone. As soon as the mind stops regenerating and recalling, it's gone. We can say it over and over again, try to kind of recreate it. And even the very notion of petunia, word, bunch of letters, a smell, a color, a particular shape, location, a summer, we can't really put our finger, our mind, our nose on it because it slips away. You just watch it, slips away. It just disappears. We don't have to do anything. It just disappears. But if we don't look closely at it, we have the imagination that something is persisting. The inner critical voice is exactly the same thing. It's only a voice. It doesn't even have a sound. It's a voice, it's a soundless voice. And if we look closely at it, what is this thing? What is this thing? What is this feeling? What is this idea? What is this belief? And we try to really pin it down and moment to moment look closely at it, we can't find it. Everybody knows that. You know, we keep thinking there's something we should be able to find despite the fact that we can't find it. We come in and say, where is it? And we say, well, I should be able to find it. I know it's in there somewhere. It's got to be real. But the reality is, it's not. It's unfindable. The inner critical voice, thoughts themselves, unfindable. When we are looking closely and intimately at them. This is true with all thought about I'm good, I'm bad, I'm not so good, I'm wrong, I am tall, I am short, I am confused, I'm hopeless, I'm great. Anytime we try to actually pin down, what is this thing I'm calling tall? Measured against what? I'm called tall compared to a safety pin. Yes, that might be true. But if I don't compare it to a safety pin, what's this thing called tall? So with direct attention, with looking directly at this thing that we're calling thought, this phenomena that we, this phenomenological experience that we call thought, if we look directly at it, we find that we have always been without thought. There is not a place before thought because thought itself is just thought. And if we look directly at it, thought, it disappears, it disappears, it disappears. Constantly check it out, verify it, make sure that's the case. There is no evidence that we're thinking except more thinking. There is no evidence that we are thinking except that more thinking. Thinking reifies thinking, reifies thinking, reifies thinking, reifies thinking, reifies thinking. If we look directly at thinking, we look directly at thought, and we can't find it. The dream reifies the dream, reifies the dream, the phantasmagoria reifies the phantasmagoria. Round and around. Body, mind, world, fluid, shifting, unfindable. Now, if we look even more carefully at this, in order to experience something, we have to have a beginning, middle, and end. Is that true? Worth investigating. But the end hasn't come yet. Actually, the end never comes. You know, the end is always in the future. It will end because when it ends, it's now. The past is already gone. Never has no existence, just a memory. We can't experience the past. We can't experience the future. Well, what is the present? I'm going to put my attention right on the present, and before I know it, fluid. It just disappears, disappears, disappears. In a way, the definition of the present is experienceable. Well, I look directly at experience. What is the experience of being present? Right here, right now, in this body that hurts, in this mind that is seething. What is the experience if I put my mind directly, directly, directly? We can actually see that time and change and flow is a function of memory, a function of thought. It's nice, but that's what it is. No thought, no time. No thought, no beginning, middle, and end. It doesn't mean things don't flow and change. But it's worth investigating, worth looking at, worth taking our basic assumptions and saying, okay, let me look even at a basic assumption like I am thinking. It's a basic assumption we all have, I am thinking. But we can't find the thinker. We can't find the thinking. It all... strands of fog. And yet we suffer. It hurts. We're sitting up late at night, and we feel tired, and our mind is seething, and we hurt, and whatever your experience is. But we didn't create any of these sensations. There's no I, me, and my that generated this flow that generated this imponderable experience. And if the mind is not thinking, and if we're just looking at the imponderable experience with the imponderable experience, it doesn't mean things are static. It means things continue to flow in a mysterious way. Like a computer monitor is totally still, and yet there's lots of activity on it that can be. So, it doesn't matter what the mind is, how the mind is judging. The mind is judging, oh, I did good, I did bad, this is working well, this is not working well, I am special, I am not special, I am a total idiot, I am da-da-da-da. It does not matter. Mind can say anything. It does. What matters is, are we looking directly at the flowing, unfindable moment, unmediated, in the seeing there's only the seen, in thinking there's only the thought, and then it disappears. And with this deep investigation, we recognize the wholeness, the completeness, the unbornness, the undyingness, the tingling luminosity. But this is not complete either. So before Sesshin, someone showed me an Oculus, the virtual reality machine that you can look through. We're sitting in a phenomenon of kind of universal universe background, infinite stars and space. I realized, oh, that's the way we can do Zazen. We can sit from the outside in. We don't have to sit from the inside out. Oh, yeah, I'm inside and inside there somewhere. I can't find myself. I don't know that, but I'm sure I'm inside here somewhere, and I know everything that happens to this thing. The whole story, the whole narrative. But if we are sitting with our mind just wide, no content, just wide, just spaciousness, just like the endless dark, if you're in a dark room, the boundless dark. If we're sitting in that way, then inside of that marvelous stillness, that marvelous tingling aliveness, all kinds of things happen. In the boundaryless, timeless spaciousness of our own mind, all kinds of things are bubbling up out of nowhere, being seen, disappearing, frothing. In this boundless space of our own being, there's all kinds of seeming activity. It's nice. I like good stories. So the difference might be, like, if you're feeling a finger with your thumb, how can you do that? You have an opposable thumb, and you're feeling a finger. If you look at it from the side of the thumb is the one who is generating the experience. If you look at it from the side of the finger, it has a different experience, it's a different generation. And yet, it's the same experience. So whether you're looking at the relative from the relative side or from the absolute side, the absolute only exists in the relative, if you're looking at them, it's in a way like just simply the same experience, just looked at different way. Moving, yet nothing moves. Here there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. And it sounds like these two are different in a way, like there's some absolute truth out there and there's some relative truth in here, but the absolute truth only exists in the relative mind. It's only ignorance only exists from the mind of knowing. When we know things, then there's ignorance. But if we don't even know anything, if our mind is really spacious, ignorance doesn't exist. Take a look. Just a couple more iterations, and we'll get back to the Platform Sutra. So right here, right now, looking at this ephemeral, whatever this ephemeral thing we call I is, this familiar concatenation of this cacophony, really, of thought and opinion. And looking right at this cacophony of thought and opinion, watching it arise out of nowhere, watching it disappear into nowhere, right there, out of nowhere, into nowhere, where does it exist? Out of nowhere, into nowhere, where is this life? Out of nowhere, into nowhere, what is born? Out of nowhere, into nowhere, what is died? When we die, where do we go? From that vantage point, no coming, no going. But if we think that there's some absolute place out there, oh yeah, there's no coming, there's going, there's just this, and we're separated from the experience of life. We think that there's an absolute that's separate from the experience of dying, from the experience of living, from the experience, then we are confused. So let's go back to the Platform Sutra. Now that we've added confusion. Weinang, the person who's going to become the sixth ancestor, lived in the around 700. And this particular sutra was developed over the next, you know, probably refined over the next century or two. And the whole first part of the sutra is, frankly, just confused and diluted. So he shows up in front of the fifth ancestor's place, made bows. He says, What do you want? What do you want? I want to be a Buddha. Nothing else. And then the ancestor, fifth ancestor, says, you know, as I mentioned, you're a dissolute, fat, lazy American, full of greed. Why could you become a Buddha? And he says, our bodies are not different, you know, our minds are not different. Isn't that interesting? We kind of have this idea of purity. We have this idea of, oh yes, in the vast, pure space of beingness, there is this bright, luminous self, and it is somehow separate from the dross, the corruption, the confusion. That somehow I, as a pure being, am now floating slightly above the humanness of the experience. In the Vajrayana, they talk about that samsara and nirvana are like the finger and the thumb. That samsara and nirvana are both intimately, intimately connected. And that the same exact experience, when looked at deeply, like we talked about first, the same exact experience of failure, of loss, of heartbreak, the same exact experience, when looked at deeply, is and reflects and shows and opens up the mind of prajna, the mind of wisdom, without being different. The fifth ancestor wished to continue the conversation, but seeing his disciples gathering on all sides, he ordered his visitor to follow the group and go off to work. Wouldn't say work on the road, go out and chop blackberries, you know. Go dig in the mud. Do something. Now, life is constantly testing us. So in this particular little story, the fifth ancestor comes and he throws out a test and says, you know, you're a fat, lazy American, and see whether it sticks, whether there's anybody in there who think, yes, that's who I am, really. and therefore I should feel ashamed and embarrassed and cringe, and there's nobody in there. Nobody in there. But if we listen to that kind of teaching, then we somehow think, oh yes, it's somebody in a teaching role should be insulting and should be unrespectful, and that's a test, and occasionally you poke at people. But life is always testing us. Always, always, always testing us. Are we caught by our ideas? Are we caught by this particular pair of pants? Are we caught by our clothing? Are we caught by our hairstyle? Are we caught by how people look at us? Always trying to put us in a box and trying to say, oh, you're a this, oh, you're a that, oh, I understand you. Life is constantly testing us to see, are we caught? Are we caught? Have we looked directly to see, oh, yeah, there's this particular shape and form and feelings right now, and it's fluid and, up and down, and sometimes I feel devastated, and sometimes it's just clear, and life is constantly testing us. The test is, are we stuck? Are we caught? Not do we experience or don't experience a particular thing. It's always testing us. Are you flowing? Weinang, back to the text, Weinang informs the High Master that this disciple's mind constantly produces wisdom and is not separate from self-nature. If somebody says that to you, I'm constantly producing wisdom, that doesn't bode very well for your relationship. That's why I say this whole thing is now set up, because the disciples of Weinang, or the disciples of the Southern School, are really set out to vilify and to denigrate. So they'll look good. Hey, we are right. You are obviously idiots. One day the fifth ancestor, summoned his disciples together and said, I have something to say to you. For people in the world, the matter of birth and death is a great one. For people not in the world, the matter of birth and death is a great one. All day long, you seek fields of blessings. You do not try to get out of the bitter sea of birth and death. If you are confused about your self-nature, how can blessings save you? We're confused about our self-nature. How can blessings save us? When we have not examined, like we're examining during this retreat and right now, when we're not really examining what is it that's alive, what is it? Then we think, a new toy. Obviously, a new toy will refresh and amuse me. And, it's nice to have new toys. But if we go thinking, I will make a collection of them, and my collection, that will prove that I really am doing okay. It doesn't hold much water. And so he said, the fifth ancestor says, everybody compose a poem. Show me your true mind. Express it. Now, it is important for all of us, as we are practicing and as we have insights of one sort or another, as we have openings into one sort or another, it has to be lived. It has to be tested. It has to be challenged. It has to be expressed in one way or another. It can be expressed as how we work with blackberries. It can be expressed by how we work with pots in the kitchen. It can be expressed by how we deal with orioki. It has to be expressed in some way or other. We're not just sitting there in a cave saying, okay, here I am, deeply, profoundly awakened, radiating my my awakenedness to the whole world. That's an idea that there's some thing that is separate from the dross of humanity. It has to be expressed. And so we have to express it. And the way to express it in the Zen school is we express it in our daily life. We express our, if we have understanding or if we have clarity, if we have insight, we express it in how we put our shoes, how we eat our oryoki, how we do meals, how do we serve, how do we let go of ourselves and help others. We express it. It has to be expressed one way or another. If it's not expressed and we're sitting there thinking, oh, I'm pretty special and nobody really recognizes it but me, it doesn't quite carry much weight. So how do we express it? Well, we have to express our understanding according to our circumstances. So if you're a brand new mother, you have to express your understanding as a brand new mother. If you're a neophyte and just learning, you're callow in your understanding and you're just learning to how to work in the shop, then that has to be expressed in that newness, in that openness. If you happen to find yourself in charge, you have to express understanding through whatever circumstances our particular karma has brought us at the time. And always there's something that's being presented. Something that's being presented. Things are changing and presenting ourselves and saying, okay, can you meet this? Can you meet this? Can you meet this? Not as I myself will now meet that thing, but can you, from the big view, watch the response freely and constantly arising to the circumstances of our particular unique life? And not thinking, oh, there are better circumstances over there, and if I just got to wear green instead of having to wear blue, then obviously my illumined mind will show up better. So the master in this particular story made up by Hui Neng's disciples, says, everybody, go out and make a poem. And then, you know, as is always the case with us human beings, we think, well, it's hard work, you know. I'll let Fuho do the work, you know. I don't have to. He's the guy sitting in that seat. I'll let him do the work. I won't have to struggle with making the meal. I won't have to struggle with giving a talk. I won't have to struggle with organizing the garden. I won't have to struggle with, I'll let somebody else will do it. Somebody else will step forward. But so that's kind of the way human beings tend to think, or else they go just the opposite and saying, I know exactly what's right. Everybody bow to me and I will lead you to freedom. So anyhow, the senior disciple, Shin Sui, writes a verse, goes through all the machinations of writing a verse, and in the story, of course, he's full of doubt and hesitation, and he wants to presume. I mean, it's all just made up. It's all made up just to make him look bad, you know, by the disciples of Wei Nang. They want the hero of the story, Wei Nang, to look really good. So everything Wei Nang says is gold from the lips of the Buddha, but they want everybody else to kind of look, you know, kind of small-minded and weak and silly. I mean, that is not Dharma. You know, that's basically not Dharma. You know, we are better and he is worse, and he is an idiot, and we are golden shining lights full of wisdom. I mean, that's not Dharma. So this thing starts off. And he gives a poem. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a mirror stand. Time and again, brush it clean. Let no dust alight. Polish, clean, vacuum, wash the dishes. What is wrong with that? Polish, clean, vacuum, you know, do your laundry. You know, wash the dishes. What is wrong with that? And in this particular story, I mean, the fifth ancestor says, well, this is great, you know, go do that. That's great. Work on your mind. Keep looking, keep investigating. And in the story, the Shinsui goes back to his room and has a restless night and is troubled, waiting for somebody to improve him, and says, oh, the fifth ancestor, does he like me? Does he not like me? Will he give me a pat on the head? Will he not? Will he give me this? Will he not give me? I mean, you know, that state of mind is just confusion. The poem is great, you know, but the state of mind of, does he love me? Does he love me not? Is confusion. And then, you know, things happen. Sixth ancestor comes and writes his poem. It's a nice story, you know. The fifth ancestor says, please, someone write a poem. Please express your understanding. Sun Wei does his very best. He looks into his heart. He tries to give something that's really genuine, something that's really present, something that really is of benefit to people. Clearly, it's something that is a benefit to people. He says that. Fifth ancestor says, yep, that's really, really good. And then this arrogant little guy comes along, Wei Nang, and says, huh, I'm better. I'm superior. You know, here's my verse. Originally, Bodhi has no tree. The bright mirror has no stand. Originally, there's not a single thing. Where can the dust alight? Well, if that's the case, nothing ever gets cleaned. If that's the case, if it's just sitting around having no tree and no stand and no single thing, then the dishes don't get done. I mean, this is not some, you know, he sort of says, oh, look at this. There's this superior understanding, voila. But really, it has no relationship to anything. Just a faint of just an idea in the mind. Originally, the Bodhi has no tree, has no foundation, has no base. The bright mirror has no stand, the mirror that reflects the life having no stand. Not a single thing. It's crazy. It's crazy. And yet in the sutra they tout, oh wow, this is the real thing. You know? Now, it's like the thumb and the finger touching. One hand there is no mirror, on the other hand, we have to constantly keep it clean. On one hand there is nothing but space and emptiness. On the other hand, if we don't do the dishes, we got big problems. So in a way, these are not one is superior, one is inferior, not one is better, but simply they're complements, equal complements. Without one, the other does not exist. They're equal complements. So as we're practicing, you know, how we live is the manifestation of the Dharma. And then it goes on from there. The bottom line is, each of us in our own skin, with our particular karmic bundle, and you know, with karma means that if you have apple seeds, you're going to get apples. If you have pomegranate seeds, you're going to get pomegranates. If you have an elbow that goes this way, it doesn't bend the other direction. Karma means there's a pattern, a shape from innumerable causes and conditions, something that has come forward. And karma means that pattern, that shape, that particular unfolding is kind of the way it is. You know, apple seeds always grow into, if they grow at all, into apple trees. But in the midst of our particular personal karma, our particular personal life, our particular investigation of the nature of things, in right in the middle of that, there is this investigation of what is it? What is it? What is it? What is it that moves and breathes? What is it that thinks? What is it that has thought? Even as we are vacuuming the floor. Not that I do any vacuuming anymore. Right in the middle of our life. Right? So, there is no conclusion that any of us have made about this retreat that is accurate. They're all wrong. So you can relax. There is no conclusion that I make or Chosen or Fuho or any of you make that is on the spot. They're all incomplete. They're all inadequate. So we can all relax and just say, okay, I'm going to just spend some time really looking carefully, seeing what this breath is about. What's breathing here? And then, of course, the next piece of it is, in order to look at something carefully, we have to accept that it's there. We have to accept, oh yeah, there's something to investigate here. It's not nothing, there's something. So I'm going to investigate the experience. I'm going to look into the experience, however it is. The essence of being able to investigate and look into the experience is we have to accept it. We have to accept this particular concatenation of karma, causes and conditions. We have to accept it. And in order to accept it, we can look into it. In order to accept it and look into it, we can see its true nature. And the essence of acceptance is loving kindness. No acceptance, no loving kindness. So in a way, from another vantage point, we can bypass this whole business and just say, I'll just practice loving kindness. And forget all this stuff that we just talked about. Just be kind.